It, in general, doesn't predict the actual outcomes of experiments, but just the probabilities with which different outcomes will occur. This is certainly true if you consider two non-commuting observables, as captured by the uncertainty principle. And so there's been this very old question of whether or not it's actually possible to somehow imagine that quantum theory is a statistical description of underlying physical properties. So now there's a lot of different jargonistic terms that people use to refer to what they mean by these physical properties. John Bell calls them beables. Others call them ontic states, from the Greek word ontos, which refers to what is. And a more common term is hidden variables. So these are physical properties that are not hidden from view necessarily, but hidden within the quantum mechanical description. And so what's the answer to this question? Sorry, I'll put a question mark just to be clear what I'm talking about. So is it possible? Does anyone know, say, of an explicit construction? Thank you. Yes? She suggested the pilot wave theory of de Broglie-Bohm would be an explicit example of such a theory. And that's correct. So the answer is yes, we can. Did you want to add something? You want to look at it.
Locality.
Oh, if you want locality, okay, yes. Yes. Yes, well, I mean, because there is this tradition of, you know, the reality is only there if we look kind of thing, so I thought that's what you were getting at. Yeah, so the point, well, yeah, that's exactly where I'm going, which is that we're going to put what we think are reasonable constraints on the properties of such a completion of quantum theory, and find out that whatever these beables are, they have to they don't satisfy these reasonable constraints. So the answer is yes, and there's the but. Let me put a little asterisk here. But such beables do not satisfy certain plausible constraints, features, properties. constraints. In particular, locality. And so my asterisk is just an example is the de Broglie-Bohm pilot wave theory. slash interpretation, I guess it's more.
See that if a quantum theory is statistical, then it's incomplete. But what do you mean by complete in this sense?
I'll give you exactly a paradigmatic model of that. That's what tells it. That's what we're going to discuss today. So what does it mean to complete the theory?
Okay, so there's a few different ways to conceive of this. We're going to consider what's called the EPRB setup. Of two spin half particles. So EPRB stands for EPR from the EPR experiment. Remember, in EPR, they considered particles that were in some kind of spatially entangled state heading away from each other. So Bohm had the innovation to just think about this in a four-dimensional Hilbert space where you have two spin half particles that start out in an entangled state, a singlet state. And so we have a source. And the idea is that we send one system over here to Alice, another system goes over here to Bob. And now Alice and Bob can chooses So Alice can choose to measure her, so this is a, say, some spin half particle, and this is another spin half particle. And Alice can choose to measure along one of two axes, along axis A, or axis A prime. And similarly, Bob can choose B, can choose between, I guess I shouldn't say or, I said or here. And then the point is we have Alice has an outcome. which we define to be some variable A, which depends on A, and we allow it to depend on arbitrary other properties. And we say that A takes on values in the interval minus 1 to 1. And Bob also has so in fact, one can also, I'll just put, or you can assume equally well that A is in the interval 0, 1, is just minus 1 or 1. So what we're going to derive is not going to depend on whether we assume that A has some continuous set of outcomes in this interval, or whether A just has discrete outcomes at the extremes of the interval. The result will follow under either assumption. So this is kind of taking into account the natural quantization of properties. But if we don't want to assume that, because that's something that quantum mechanics tells us, we just allow there to be some range of continuous outcome values. So the key point the key assumption here is that A cannot depend on the detector setting B. And similarly, B cannot depend on the detector setting of A. So this is a locality assumption. And we can justify it by saying that the measurement here, that these are space-like separated. This is a locality assumption which we can motivate by imagining or by enforcing that the measurement events of Alice and Bob are space-like separated. So then there's no possibility of communication. I mean, really what we want to do is exclude two scenarios. One is that Alice would get some outcome and communicate it to Bob. And the other is that somehow, independently of the agency of Alice and Bob, that you wouldn't want Alice to choose her setting and for that to be able to influence the outcome over here. And you can guarantee that's not going to happen if these are outside each other's light cones. Now, there's other ways to enforce it, but this is the strongest way to enforce it. So just I'll remark that this is an assumption of context independence of non-contextuality, which basically means a kind of context independence motivated by special relativity. So you think that's a pretty innocent assumption, and it's kind of surprising that such an innocent assumption can in fact have such dramatic consequences. So now we want to consider correlations between the outcomes. So the idea is that Alice and Bob would perform their measurement, and we can repeat this experiment many times. We push the button on the source, two particles come out, Alice and Bob perform a measurement, and repeat. And then after all of their data is collected and written down in their lab books, then Alice and Bob can get together and analyze the data by looking at statistical properties of their outcomes. So we define what's sometimes called a correlation function between A, which depends on A, and B, which depends on B. Which is an expectation over runs or repetitions of A times B. Now, the expectation over runs, we can imagine, happens because these unspecified parameters lambda, which could be the hidden variables, say, could have some statistical distribution. So we're going to allow CAB to correspond to an average over runs experimentally. So here we take the limit as n goes to infinity of 1 over n. So sorry, let me say experimentally. Limit over n, sum over n, a n, b n. And conceptually, we imagine that C of AA and BB is equal to an integral over anything that we haven't specified in our description. So these are the lambdas. So the lambdas are going to belong to some set of allowed values. And they'll have some probability density. And we would have A of A comma lambda and B of B comma lambda. So typically one imagines that lambda are kind of properties of the source. Right? So typically, lambda would be created at the source or determined by the source of the two spin half particles. Or equivalently well, you could just think of lambda are properties carried by the particles. It could be instruction sets or internal degrees of freedom or anything else that we haven't discovered yet because our scientific program is incomplete. So then it follows that one has the following result, which is called a Bell inequality, which is that C AA BB plus C AA B B prime plus C A A prime B B, and then mine, so we're just adding these up in some particular linear combination here. Is less than or equal to 2. Okay, so how do we see this? We first remark that A of A comma lambda times B of B comma lambda plus A of A comma lambda B of B prime comma lambda plus A of A prime comma lambda B of B comma lambda plus A of A prime comma lambda B of B prime comma lambda can be re-expressed as A times oh, thank you. So now the reason for rewriting it in this way, which is a fairly simple manipulation, so here we're going to assume here that for simplicity, and because this is the actual way the experiments work, let's just take A and B to be equal to minus 1 and plus 1. Now the key point is that we're taking the same combination of the outcome B for detector setting B and the outcome B for detector setting B prime in a given run, and we're looking at the difference between them. Now B and B prime are equal to plus 1 and minus 1. So if this one's equal to plus 1 and this one's equal to plus 1, then this is 2 and this is 0. If this one's equal to plus 1 and this one's equal to minus 1, then this is 0, and this term is 2. So the point is you can write down all four possibilities, and it follows trivially that either this one is 2 and this one is plus or minus 2 and this one is 0, or vice versa. Those are the only two possibilities, that one of these terms is 0 and the other one is plus or minus 2. So the bracketed term or vice versa, where you just swap the plus and minus sign in here. Now A is equal to, let's assume that this term is 0 and this term is plus or minus 2. Now A is just equal to 1 or minus 1. So we have plus or minus 1 times plus or minus 2, which is of course bounded above by 2. Similarly here, if this term is 0 and this term is plus or minus 2, then we're multiplying it by either 1 or minus 1, so therefore we're guaranteed that this expression is less than or equal to 2. Let's call this equation star. Now, there are some applying some simple inequalities, which I won't go through. You could also prove that this result holds even if we allow A and B to take on continuous values in this range. So I'll leave that as an exercise. When A and B take on continuous values in the interval minus 1 plus 1. So you can find this in any textbook which discusses Bell's inequalities. It's also on the Wikipedia page if you want to find the easiest reference. think I'm running out of chalk. Oh, is there a box over there? Perfect. All right, so any questions so far about what we're doing, the setup, the mathematics? So far, so good. It's all pretty gentle. Okay, good. Now that we've written some things down, why don't we
just go through it again one more time?
So obviously what we're going to show is that quantum mechanics is going to violate this inequality. So we should look carefully at what the assumptions are going in. In fact, their whole conference is devoted to that. What are the assumptions that go into this simple result? But basically we have observables which have outcomes in some finite range, A and B. We allow Alice and Bob to be able to choose detector settings, A and B. So here we implicitly assume that A or A prime and B or B prime are chosen independently which you can motivate, say, by Alice and Bob having free will, but you don't need to do that. But that is an issue that comes up in this context. You could also imagine there's some random number generator which chooses A or A prime every nanosecond, and then whatever the random number generator tells you to measure, you measure that. And similarly for Bob. And then once they collect their data, all their measurement outcomes, then what Alice and Bob would do is look at, well, how many times, what's the correlation between A and B? So maybe it would be a good idea to clarify exactly what that means operationally. So here we say the correlation, so experimentally or operationally, the correlation of A B B is equal to the number of outcomes in which A and B are the same, so up versus down, plus the number of outcomes where they're both up, number of outcomes where they're both down, minus the number of outcomes where the first one is up and the second one is down, minus the number of outcomes where the first one is down and the second one is up, divided by the total number n of runs, and that reflects the correlation. This is how you. This is a standard way you would check if two variables are correlated. Are they more often the same than they're different? And this is, of course, defining the limit that n goes to infinity, but one would always have some statistical precision issues, but that can be made arbitrarily small in principle and in practice. Well, I guess that doesn't make sense, but it can be made small enough in practice. We'll discuss later some of the experimental loopholes, but let's for now just get the result. Yeah, that's right. So I think you could equally well define it as if ever the outcome is in the interval 0, 1 versus minus 1, 0. So you're always free to bin the continuous variable and satisfy this. That's another reason why, it's kind of natural to consider continuous variables because of classical physics. But if you had a continuous outcome between plus 1 and minus 1, you could always enforce a discrete. You could say, okay, well, I'm going to call anything that's greater than 0 plus and anything that's less than 0 minus. And thereby define a discrete observable. So that's what we mean by the correlation. And then in practice, one experimentally, one averages over runs, and Conceptually, you imagine that there's some hidden variables that specify these outcomes, either probabilistically or deterministically, and that gives us this correlation. And then we just considered a kind of a non-trivial linear combination of the different possible detector settings, where we take three possible settings and add them and subtract off a fourth one. And we can show using very simple mathematics that, in fact, this is bounded above by two, these correlations. And the key assumption involved in being able to do that was, the key assumption was written somewhere here, is that we didn't allow A to depend on B or B prime, and we didn't allow capital B to depend on A versus A prime. That's the locality assumption. And that's the one that's suspected to be the problem. Yes?
Yes, that's right. In fact, that's an important point, that one kind of is interested in this kind of problem because one wants to understand something about invariables. But as people have said, this whole result is just about the outcomes of experiments. Even if you don't believe in invariables, it's showing that outcomes of experiments violate an assumption that the outcome at A doesn't depend on the setting at B. And so it has nothing to do with whether you believe in hidden variables or not. It's just that people that are interested in hidden variables, historically it's the way it was done is what it is. Historically it was about hidden variables, but nowadays we realize that it's a much more powerful result than that. Actually, we only got to here. I also wanted to, let me bring this back down.
Is that now that we know that this inequality holds for individual terms, now we can take an average either over runs or over hidden variables. That average can mean different things. And we can then, if it's true, if this inequality holds for each term in the average, then it holds for the average as well. So then we obtain the result we want, which is that, this is so long to write out each time, but I guess I'll do it. So the correlation corresponds to the average, and then this inequality holds also for that. So plus C A of A, B of B prime, plus C A of A prime, B of B, minus C A of A prime, B of B prime, is less than or equal to 2. And greater than or equal to minus 2. Okay, so that's fine. It doesn't seem like such a big deal. But then what you realize is, well, now let's imagine that these outcomes, A and B, are generated by measurements on a quantum system. So now we get to the quantum mechanical prediction. So let A correspond to I'll drop the vector label for convenience. Okay, so which I think I've done already. So A of A, we imagine to be equal to let me write it this way. We let the correlation of A of A, B of B be realized as the expectation value of a Pauli operator dotted with A . So here, sigma is a Pauli operator which is just a spin half angular momentum operator divided by h bar over 2. So sigma is equal to S times 2 over h bar, so that we get outcomes 1 and minus 1 instead of h bar over 2 and minus h bar over 2. And similarly for b, and a is some direction in three-dimensional space. Now remember, we looked at measurement, and one of the scenarios we looked at for measurement was the Stern-Gerlach scenario, where if you wanted to measure the spin of the particle along some axis, you would just orient the Stern-Gerlach magnet along that axis, and it would create a deflection in the trajectory of the particles up or down, depending if the spin was up or down, and then you could just measure the location of the particle and determine what spin direction it had along that axis. Similarly, this can be done with, in fact, the experiments are typically done with photon polarization, and then when it's measuring, basically just measuring the polarization of the light in some spatial direction. So these are very simple experiments in the sense of conceptually what's being measured. Yeah.
Formula that we have for the inequalities, then I can understand how to calculate the correlation function experimentally. But what's confusing me at the moment is that in some of these expressions, for example, on this middle board all the way on the right, right beneath the line that says results, we have three terms that are positive and one that's negative. I'm wondering how we determine which are positive and which is negative. In the calculation of C from experiments, it's down there. It's clear to me why some terms are negative and some are positive. Is there a relation between what determines the signs?
So when you're saying what determines the signs, creativity determines the signs. So the idea is that this particular combination tells us something that other combinations don't tell us. So it's more of, it's not that one has to put a minus sign there, but the point is each of these quantities, C, with the different A and B settings, are different possible experiments you can do. And now we're just combining the data in a particular linear combination that happens to be interesting. So one chooses the minus sign there because that leads to interesting results. If you just added them all up, then you would be less than or equal to 4, probably. Yeah, I think. I'm not sure, but so it's just right? One doesn't have to put in minus sign there. This is a theorem. I mean, what I should have wrote, instead of result, I can say, you know, consider this combination of the experimental data. And in fact, instead of result, I should actually just call this a theorem. This is Bell's theorem. So it's actually Bell CHSH. So it's also sometimes called an inequality instead of a theorem. It's a matter of taste. People mean the same thing by it. Clauser, Holt, Clauser, Horn, Shimoni, and Holt are the authors who kind of improved upon Bell's original result to remove the assumption of determinism and also this kind of more common expression now, which is the one experimentalists typically test. So typically there's a family of Bell inequalities of which this is one. And it's not the original one. Yeah.
You probably want absolute values or?
Yeah. Thank you. In fact, it's a matter of taste. I mean, the point is we're going to choose a set of quantum measurement axes which can either make this quantity equal to 2 square root of 2 or minus 2 square root of 2. So, but to be consistent there, I agree, yeah. Now, I think, Nicole, you had, was there another question packed in there? Oh, that's fine? Okay, good. So, okay, so this is the measurement, or the pair of measurements that by Alice and Bob. Each one is measuring on the same preparation, so psi is a preparation at the source. They each get half of this state, or one particle from the source that was created by the disjoint preparation of psi, and then they measure simultaneously spin components along randomly chosen directions. Alice chooses A or A prime, Bob chooses B or B prime, and it's critical that these be independent choices. And in particular, we consider a very special preparation. Which is equal to plus tensor minus, this is A, B, minus tensor plus A, B, which is the singlet state of two spin half particles, which you've all seen, I hope. So this is a maximally entangled state of two particles. So you can see that by calculating the von Neumann entropy of the reduced density operator and finding that it's a half. Sorry, not a half. The purity is a half. The entropy would be, I think, a half too in this case, actually. And actually, which brings me to the answer to a question you asked last week, which was, why is the von Neumann entropy the right way to measure the degree of entanglement? I mean, it was pretty clear, I think, from that lecture that entropy gives you certainly a yes-no answer as to whether it's entangled. Then the question is, why is the numerical value of entropy, which is equal to rho, you know, minus trace of rho log rho, why is that the kind of preferred way to measure the degree or amount of entanglement in some mixed state preparation? And the reason is that in the instance of you have some preparation rho of two systems, and you have an arbitrarily large number of copies of that rho, so pick some n which is huge, so asymptotically you ask, how many, now I can apply
operations, joint operations to these n copies a row, and if your goal is to extract out some smaller number of copies which are maximally entangled, in particular which are maximally entangled Bell pairs, so maximally entangled states of this form, then the number of such copies you will get is equal to the binomial entropy S times n, which is the number of copies of the mixed state you have. So it measures how much maximally entangled Bell pairs you can extract from that state. So that's why it's a very operationally relevant measure. Okay, so that was a digression. All right, so now we look at this singlet state, which is sometimes just called a Bell state, or in fact, there are four maximally entangled states called Bell states.
And this is one of them. And then now you have all the ingredients you need to calculate this quantity for arbitrary angles A, A prime, B, and B prime. Now, it's a simple exercise to calculate to show that C of AA BB is equal to, maybe I'll just use the quantum expression, that psi of sigma dot A tensor sigma dot B is equal to minus the cosine of theta AB. Where theta AB is the angle between A and B. What's this? Is it the angle subtended? What's the right word? Subtended? For those of you who are not native English speakers, it's angle between these two vectors. So the point is that, the key point is that, so then what we can do is we can choose, A, A prime, B, and B prime to be coplanar. So they're all within one plane in three-dimensional space, and then so this is, let's choose A and A prime to be 90 degrees apart. So A would be measuring, say, Z up versus Z down. And B, A prime, would be measuring X up versus X down. And then we can choose B and B prime to be at 90 degree angles, but rotated by 45 degrees with respect to A and A prime. Now, just remember which one is B prime. A, B, right, this is B prime. So this, here, figure one. the choices in figure one
produce a maximal violation of Bell inequalities. Which we can see by, so you guys can't really see here so well, right? I guess I'll have to move. Okay. Can you see above this line? Can I just write right here just so I don't have to, okay, great. So what you get is C of AB is equal to C of, sorry, I'm really going shorthand notation here. All right, so when I say C of AB, I mean C of A of A and B of B. And so what I have, AB, AB prime, A prime, B prime, are all equal to minus 1 over square root of 2, and C of, this is B prime, C of A prime B is equal to plus 1 over square root of 2. So then when we take, when we substitute that into this expression, we get 3 over square root of 2, or minus 3 over square root of 2. Well, I'll just substitute. So I don't really like to do this normally, but I'm just going to go back to this point. So, maybe. Here we use a little Fortran code, keep track of where we're going. So, substituting into, so I'll just write down this expression and I'll lift the board again for those of you that didn't finish writing. Substituting into our Bell inequality, we get that C of A BB, oh man, the minus sign is on A prime, B prime there. Is this gonna, what expression does he have? Oh, I see. All right, switch notations there. Damn it. All right, so actually, so what I wanted was, for consistency of notation, I need to switch B prime and B, little b prime and B. Well, I can't just switch them here because these now, here I shouldn't do it. I see, yeah. All right, thank you. Thank you, guys. All right, good. So basically, then this is a B and this is a B prime, and I don't have too much damage. The damage control is, awesome. Yeah. Yeah, it's really tedious to write this all out, but whatever. Well, it's equal to 2 square root of 2, which is, of course, normally greater than 2. So Houston, we have a problem. So basically, what we find then is we find that quantum theory violates one or more of the innocuous assumptions of Bell's inequality. What do you think?
So maybe quantum mechanics is wrong, because we all like special relativity. So then, of course, physicists being physicists, people do experiments to check this. So really the first kind of widely considered to be definitive experiments, well, sorry, not definitive, the first compelling experiments that confirm that
the world is producing the results predicted by quantum theory and not the results predicted by the Bell inequality. The first kind of widely accepted experimental confirmation of quantum theory for this arrangement, for this setup. Of course, quantum theory has been confirmed in every other setup we've looked at, so it would be kind of odd if quantum theory failed specifically for this prediction. But of course, given that this prediction is in contradiction of a very simple principle that follows from very innocuous assumptions, one can entertain the possibility that quantum theory happens to be valid in a wide range of phenomena, but just not for this particular phenomenon. But that appears not to be the case. There have been dozens of experiments confirming the quantum mechanical prediction and therefore violating the Bell inequality. Were performed by Alain Aspect and co-workers. Let me get you the journal reference. Sorry, they're in here. So this was in the Physical Review Letters, which is a very nice place to publish, in 1982. And, you know, I've met Alain, and he's told me his stories about how much how much resistance his experiments were met with from the community, in spite of the fact that they agreed with quantum mechanics, which is kind of astounding. But there's so much kind of emotional support for this idea of locality that people are troubled by this. And so there's actually a minor industry of trying to come up with loopholes of why we don't need to believe the experiments. So usually that's a bad sign in science, these kinds of, you know, desperate attempts to find loopholes. I mean, these experiments were performed using standard techniques, which produced, you know, tons of results that were accepted by the community, but then using the same basic techniques of measuring photon polarization and so on, they're rejected. So there are several lines of criticism. I'll mention two lines of criticism to you. One is experimental, one is conceptual. So I'll mention two experimental criticisms. So the experiments have been criticized for several reasons. And here I'll just add some color commentary here, which is, you know, perhaps unfairly. At least it's uncharacteristic, I guess. Maybe whether it's fair or not is a subjective opinion, but it's certainly uncharacteristic. So similar papers using similar experimental techniques that confirm quantum mechanics do not get this kind of scrutiny. Perhaps unfairly and certainly uncharacteristically. How do you spell characteristically? Character. That's a long word, my goodness. Wow. Okay, several reasons. So one is, the detector settings were random but predetermined. So in other words, Alain and his collaborators said, okay, we need a whole bunch of experiments on spin half pairs. We need random choices of detector settings. And so they just generated some random numbers and put those into the computer and then ran the experiments, and the computer just read from this list of random numbers it had. But the point is that those random numbers weren't generated in a way that was space. So the experiments were performed in a way that was space-like separated. And if I remember my history correctly, I think that's where experiments were done previously to test Bell's inequalities, but Alain Aspect's were, I think, kind of took it to the next level, because he actually, I think that, I'm not 100% certain this is true, but I think that the detector settings were switched in a way that was space-like separated. Anyways, it was either Alain Aspect or Gregor Weiss who did that. I can't remember which now. But the detector settings are random but predetermined. And so therefore, the independence of the choices, they may not have been independent. There could have been some conspiracy by nature which made the particular choices of measurement directions to have been, kind of, I mean, it's a very conspiratorial argument, but this was fixed. This was addressed, I should say, by later experiments. Let me just make sure I'm remembering this correctly. Yeah, good, I am. Okay. Basically what they had is the measurement settings were selected and set and oriented in a space-like separated manner. Yeah, I think, okay, it was basically, this is, if I remember correctly, the idea was that in SPSS setting, I think the detector settings were fixed for each run, and then they'd change the setting, and then they'd release the source and do the measurement, and then they'd change the setting and release the source and do the measurement. And so people said, well, really, look, the whole point of this is to show that the measurements are independent, so they're space-like separated. So then what Gregor Weiss did, Gregor Weiss et al., and I don't remember the year, but I can check it in a minute, is they actually had random number generators in each apparatus and managed to randomly choose and move the direction of the measurement while the photons were in flight after they were released from the source, just to make it crystal clear that things were space-like separated. Of course, you can still find loopholes with that argument, which people do. And it becomes a bit of an infinite regress. So this was actually fairly recent. So you can still criticize this experiment as not being proving that the detector settings are independent, because you know everything is determined by a common cause, right? Say at the Big Bang, for example. So ultimately, everything goes back to that, you know, even if we don't want to go all the way back to the Big Bang, I mean, anything you and I can do over the course of our lifetimes can be traced back to some shared common light cone. And so this criticism is kind of the super determinism argument that, well, the detector settings are never really chosen independently because, you know, there could have been some conspiracy where nature made it that things evolved in just such a way that, you know, the random number generator or the free choices made by graduate students actually aren't free or random, and that everything conspires just in the right way to make it appear as though we have non-locality. So if you're shaking your head at that, we have the same opinion of that concern. So anyways, but you see that people, I mean, this is an issue, right? Another maybe more legitimate line of criticism is the fair sampling assumption. I mean, there is maybe a slightly philosophical community that points out that this is a logical loophole, even though maybe it's not a physically realistic thing to worry about.
It's pointless.
I mean, in some sense, if what we learn from Bell's inequality is that the world is super determined in that way, that's more disturbing to me than non-locality. So either way, we get something disturbing out of it. It's hardly a way to say that there's no problem with our conceptual understanding of the world. I guess I was thinking about this. I guess I kind of get into a role and I just keep going, but you guys probably want a little break between these two, 1.5. It's a bit of a morning marathon for you guys. So I can try to stop on time so you have time to like get coffee, go to the washroom or whatever. The other lecture starts at 10:30 normally, right? Okay. So let me just mention then really quickly, and after I've said all that, I will continue. The other is the fair sampling assumption. So photodetectors, and certainly polarization photodetectors, aren't 100% efficient. So every time a photon arrives, the detector doesn't click and tell you what happened. In fact, detector efficiencies are very low. They're around 5%. So what that means, because you have two photodetectors, this one, if you have a coincidence event where two particles went out, and this one's only detecting 5% of the photons it receives, and this one's only detecting 5% of the photons it receives, you can do the math. A very small fraction of coincidence events that are created by the source are actually detected by the detectors. And so what people have said, well, it could be that there's some, that if you actually had 100% detector efficiency, you would find that the correlations agree with Bell's inequality, and it's just the sample that you've taken is not a fair sample, and so it's not representative of the whole. I mean, where do you see this? When the pollsters say, okay, well, there's an election next month, and, you know, candidate A is going to win 57% of the vote, plus or minus 3%, 19 times out of 20, right? Where does that come from? Well, they don't ask everybody in the whole country what they're going to do. What they do is they take a small sample of people, and they ask them what their plan is, and that, we believe, is typically representative of the whole if you've sampled fairly. So if you just happen, if the way in which you pick people to ask them who they're going to vote for is just people that have an income over $10 million, then you're not going to get a fair sample of the way the whole society will vote. So there could be some additional factors we haven't taken into account that the particular subset of pairs that are detected have some intrinsic property which makes them more likely to be detected and gives the appearance that overall we have this superclassical correlation which violates this inequality. And that therefore we can't necessarily conclude from the inefficient samples of these pairs detected by the experiments that on the whole these correlations will violate Bell inequality. And so really the only answer to that problem is to get better photodetectors, and better photodetectors are needed for a huge variety of technological reasons. So literally, I think there are armies of graduate students around the world working on the problem of building better photodetectors, whether it's because they're dreaming of proving violations of Bell's inequality or, you know, implementing quantum information technology or whatever it is. This is an active area of kind of applied physics research. And I think I have some information about this. There's some, I can't remember this now. I read somewhere that, I think someone showed that if detector efficiencies rose above some critical threshold, then you could prove, you could drop the fair sampling assumption. So this is kind of a work in progress. But again, it's slightly conspiratorial of a concern. I mean, we don't have any reasons to expect this. And in any case, we should always keep in mind that the experiments agree with quantum mechanics, which has always been correct. So that's another reason to kind of maybe not fret over these details. OK, I will definitely stop now. Maybe at the beginning of tomorrow's lecture, if you guys have been digesting this and have some questions, we can address those then before we move on to the material for tomorrow. We either cover infinite dimensions and then path integrals, or start doing path integrals. I'll probably do that. I think I'll do infinite dimensions. I can also do Krauss operators and POVMs, but I think I'll do that next week because that's less of a priority, right? So we'll do infinite dimensions, then we'll do path integrals at some point.
Would you say something about tomorrow, the alternative, about
pilot wave theory, would you like to talk a little about that?
I can, yeah, I'll talk about that tomorrow morning.
Thank you.